Part 2. The Real Enemy. Chapter 4. The Game is Rigged. Read by Amelia. Sophie was taking her show on the road, being paid a lot to speak at corporate meetings about creating workplaces that support a diverse workforce. She was running some drafts of her talk by Emily for her pedagogical expertise. "What's that?" Emily asked, pointing to an unfamiliar word on a PowerPoint slide. "Kobayashi Maru," Sophie said, and when Emily looked blank, she explained. "It's a training simulation for Starfleet cadets, an unwinnable scenario designed to test your character. You can't win, so the goal is to lose in a way that's honorable." "A Star Trek thing?" Emily asked. "A Star Trek thing," Sophie confirmed. "That turns systemic bias into a game." She clicked to the next slide. "People hire people they know, people who went to the same schools." She pointed to the statistics graphic, then clicked to the next slide, which was full of references to implicit associations research. "They have an unconscious bias that makes them prefer people who look like them." The next slide was covered in images from movies, TV shows, video games, and comic books. "Every piece of media they consume affirms their biases," and she clicked to the next slide, which was covered in dozens of characters, all white, all men, all heroes, knights in shining armor, men in capes, mutants with telepathic abilities, wizards, detectives, wizard detectives. "They see that spaces filled with white men are not just normal, but better." Her tone lightened to her more usual geeky excitement. "So here I am, trying to rescue the ship in the neutral zone, and the Klingons are going to attack. I am going to die. The win is I prove my character every time I'm tested." "You're going to tell them outright that they're creating an unwinnable scenario?" Sophie nodded. "The science says it's good for us to name it." That science is the subject of this chapter. In the wake of violence, the first priority is to stop the bleeding and save the victim's life. But at some point, we need to go back and figure out how the bleeding started so we can prevent it from happening again. We need to talk about the knife and the person who used it against us. The tools we describe in Part 1 stop the bleeding. They can help you right now. They can quite literally save your life. Every human can complete the stress response cycle, manage their monitor, and engage with their something larger, because those resources exist inside us. You'll have access to them all your life, no matter where you go, no matter what culture you live in. But we need to talk about where that bleeding came from, the knife, and the enemy who wielded it. If you're a woman in the industrialized West, you'll confront a particular set of enemies that will try to cut you down to size over and over, and they'll lie to your face while they do it, saying it's for your own good, saying you should be grateful for their help. And because we've been confronting these enemies literally since before we were born, we often believe them. To explain, we need to talk about some rat research. We promise it's worth it. Okay, imagine two rats. Rat number one, let's call him Ralph the Rat, only pronounced Rafe, like Rafe Fiennes. In fact, let's say it's not a rat, it's actually Rafe Fiennes. He's in a box. It's called a shuttle box, with a floor that periodically electrocutes his feet. It's not painful, but it is uncomfortable. Rafe hates being electrocuted, and he wants to get out of there every time it happens. Fortunately for him, after the zapping begins, a little door opens briefly, and he can make a run for it. He escapes. His dopamine levels double as his monitor quickly learns that escaping the shock is an attainable goal. He has overcome adversity and learned that he can make a difference in his situation. Rat number two, we'll call him Colin, and let's make it Colin Firth, because why not? Is not in a box. He's in a tank of water for the forced swim test. You can tell it's bad just by the name, right? Colin, like most rats, can swim. He did it in Pride and Prejudice in A Single Man, but he doesn't love it. He'd like to get out of the water as soon as possible. So he swims and swims and swims and swims and never reaches dry land. As he keeps failing, he gets frustrated and then desperate, foopy. And ultimately, Colin's monitor switches its assessment of his goal from potentially attainable to unattainable. His dopamine levels drop by half. He feels helpless, and he just floats in a last-ditch effort to reserve energy until there's any sign of land. Here's maybe the saddest part about this. If we take Colin out of the water, dry him off, and put him into the shuttle box, he will not even try to escape the shock, though the door is right there. In the shuttle box, Colin could escape if he tried, but he can't try. His brain has learned that trying doesn't work, that nothing he does makes a difference. And so he has lost the ability to try. This inability to try is called learned helplessness. Animals, including humans, who repeatedly find themselves in bad situations from which they can't escape, may not even try to escape, even when given the opportunity. When an animal has learned helplessness, it goes straight past frustration, right to the pit of despair. It's not a rational choice. Their central nervous system has learned that when they are suffering, nothing they can do will make a difference. They have learned that they are helpless. Their only available route for self-preservation is not to try. When you read studies like these, and there are hundreds of them, part of you can't help wanting to go to the rat and let him in on the secret. Colin, this thing is rigged. The experimenters are messing with you on purpose, just to see how you'll react. That's what researchers do when they study learned helplessness in humans. In one example, researchers subjected study participants to an annoying noise that participants either could or could not turn off. Many participants in the helpless group shut down, as the rats did, and simply stopped trying to solve the problem. But researchers made sure participants didn't walk out of the experiment trapped in a pit of despair. As soon as a participant in the helpless group was shown that the noise was rigged or the problem was unsolvable, his symptoms would disappear. Just knowing that the game is rigged can help you feel better right away. And that's what this chapter is for. In the young adult dystopian series, The Hunger Games, Katniss Everdeen is forced into a game in which she has to kill other children. It's a ritual developed by the totalitarian government to control the provinces. Before she goes into the game, her mentor says, "Remember who the real enemy is. We are not our own worst enemy, nor is the enemy the other people in the game. The enemy is the game itself, which tries to convince us that it's not the enemy." Let's get started. The patriarchy. We know the word patriarchy makes many people uncomfortable. If you're one of those people, that's completely fine. You don't need to accept the word or use it to recognize the symptoms of living in it. Its messages ring inside us like a song that's been stuck in our heads so long that we don't even notice it anymore, not recognizing that it was taught to us in our infancy. On the day a baby is born, if not sooner, the adults declare either it's a boy or it's a girl. If no difference existed in the way boys and girls were treated, a baby's genitals would be no more important in deciding how the child was raised than any other part of their body. But instead, the baby is treated as if all sorts of other things about them are true. What kinds of toys they'll enjoy, what skills they'll develop, whom they'll grow up to fall in love with, and what they'll want to be when they grow up. The difference between how boys and girls are raised is gradually shrinking. More and more, fathers are in favor of their daughters possessing traditionally masculine traits like independence and strength, even if they're not so enthusiastic about their own wives or girlfriends possessing those same characteristics. But our expectations are still widely different for girls and boys. You can see how wide the difference is simply by looking at the toy aisle for girls and the toy aisle for boys. The difference isn't neutral. Being raised a boy makes it easier for boys to grow up and take on positions of power and authority, which is all patriarchy means. This takes a lot of forms. Explicit misogyny. One example of this is a reality TV star declaring he can grab women by the pussy whenever he wants because he's famous. And a flood of media coverage suggesting that this sort of thing is perfectly okay, just locker room talk. Imagine if he, or a woman, had said he can grab men by the dick whenever he wanted. Or a young man goes on a murderous rampage, killing several people and injuring many more, and justifies it by saying women refuse to have sex with him. In response to one such mass murderer who identified as an incel, involuntarily celibate, the New York Times ran an op-ed that unjokingly argued that redistribution of sex, that is, sex for men, with women, was a reasonable idea. You see, women could be preventing these deaths if only they did their job of meeting the sexual needs of dangerous men. In the time that we were writing this book, there were 15 public mass shootings in the United States, perpetrated by men or boys, several of whom were motivated, at least in part, by some form of jealousy, sexual frustration, or emotional rejection by a woman or girl. In more than half of all mass shootings, the perpetrator kills his intimate partner or family members, including his mother, his wife or girlfriend, or his children. Sex and relationship violence. Sexual assault disproportionately and systematically targets women. Women are 3 times more likely than men to be assaulted, while 95% of sex offenders are men. 1 in 5 American women college students experience sexual assault or attempted sexual assault during college. Globally, men who rape women report that their primary motivation is the basic belief that they have a right to a woman's body regardless of how she feels about it, a belief termed sexual entitlement in their research. Women are held responsible for being assaulted based on how they lead men on with behavior or attire, but perpetrators are disproportionately under-prosecuted. At the same time, public officials accused of sexual assault are allowed to defend themselves by implying that the woman making the accusation is too ugly to rape. In addition to the threat of acute physical and sexual violence, women face chronic gendered stressors every day. These experiences of patriarchy are like traffic noise in a big city. If you live there, you get so used to it, you hardly notice it anymore, but that doesn't make it less noisy. The noise includes body image. We talk about this extensively in Chapter 5, so we'll save a complete discussion for then, but we want to mention now that body dysmorphia and disordered eating disproportionately and systematically impact women more than men, and that dynamic is already in place by elementary school, with half of 6-year-old girls worrying they're too fat. And let's remember that eating disorders have the highest mortality of any mental health issue. Body image isn't about vanity. Women's lives are on the line. Getting a word in edgewise. Again, the dynamic is already in place by elementary school. Boys speak up and call out answers 8 times more than girls. Among grown-ups, in meetings where men are the majority, women speak 1/3 less than men. Only when there are more women than men do women speak as much as men. During President Barack Obama's first term in office, his women's staffers struggled so much to get their voices heard that they coordinated an amplification tactic where when one of them made a key point, the others would repeat it, crediting the original speaker. Even President Obama, a self-declared feminist, needed active intervention to create gender balance. In rat research, these kinds of pervasive problems are called chronic mild stress. Rats may be deprived of food and water for unpredictable but not dangerous periods of time. Their cages tilted at a 45-degree angle for a few hours. Water poured on their bedding. Strobe lights flashed for hours at a time. Everything is just a little bit too hard, so that every day, bit by bit, the survivable helplessness eats away at them. In human terms, researchers are creating for these rats a context of one damn thing after another. In the 21st century West, one damn thing after another is what being a woman often feels like. It's a constant, low-level stream of stressors that are out of your control. Most individual examples are little more than an annoyance, but they accumulate. We're not saying life isn't difficult for everyone, or that men and boys don't struggle with these issues too. They do. The pressure to conform to an ever-shrinking mold is increasing, as companies discover how much profit there is to be made from telling men they aren't valuable unless they have six-pack abs or instantaneous erections. People of every gender die in mass murders, often including the killer. And men are more likely to die by violence, including at their own hand. Misogyny doesn't just kill women. But that's another book. We're here to address the fact that we exist in an environment where women are more likely than men to get back to their nest to find someone has poured water on their bedding. Womanhood as a chronic low-level stress is even messier than it sounds for two reasons. First, it's very possible that female and male biologies respond differently to that stress. When male rats are exposed to these chronic mild stressors, their swim time in the forced swim drops in half pretty much right away. After 6 weeks, it drops in half again. Female rats, by contrast, take 3 weeks to drop their swim time in half, and it doesn't change after 6 weeks. Female rats exposed to chronic mild stressors persist more than males do. They work harder in the face of difficulty. It takes twice as long for their brains to shift into helplessness. Even female rats, it seems, hashtag persist. And second, one of the stressors we experience is being told we're not experiencing any more or different stress than men. One aspect of the patriarchy, in the modern West, is that it says it doesn't exist anymore. Gaslighting. Remember the movie Gaslight? Ingrid Bergman's husband flickers the lights, gaslights from before electricity, but tells her she's imagining it. He puts a watch in her bag and tells her she stole it. He snoops around in the attic looking for her dead aunt's jewels and tells Ingrid she's imagining the footsteps she hears. He denies her contact with other people, saying it's for her own good because clearly her nerves are shaky. Isolated and trapped, what can she do but believe him? In the movie, Ingrid Bergman is finally vindicated when a policeman, dreamboat Joseph Cotton, comes to her house and says, "Yes, the gaslights are flickering. You are not crazy." This story resonated so strongly with generations of moviegoers that gaslighting has become a term to describe the larger phenomenon of women and other marginalized groups being told over and over that it's their imagination. That thing people do when they tell you you're imagining the discrimination, they're gaslighting you. And that feeling you have when someone is doing it to you, but you're not sure because maybe they're right and you're overreacting and being too sensitive, like you can't trust your own senses, except what your senses are telling you is unambiguous. That's feeling gaslit. You're filled with simultaneous doubt, fear, rage, betrayal, isolation, and panicked confusion. You can feel that a situation is wrong, but you can't explain why or how. So you worry that you misunderstood something, or you feel inadequate for being unable to articulate your objection. It's hard to go to a friend and explain what happened, how you reacted, and why. Without recognizing gaslighting for what it is, you might even hesitate to share that story at all because gaslighting is designed to make you question your own credibility and competence. But rest assured, you're not wrong or stupid. You've been gaslit. Pundits on TV inform us that sexism isn't a thing anymore, hashtag not all men, and P.S. neither is racism, hashtag all lives matter. So if we're not paid as much as the men or the white people we work with, that's because we haven't earned it. Or worse, because men ask for what they want, and if we would just ask, we would get it. And if we ask but we don't get it, it's because we didn't ask the right way. Magazines tell us that if we just drink 10 green smoothies a day, we'll feel great and look great, and our kids will say please and thank you, and our boss will give us that promotion. And if none of those things happen, it's because we failed to drink the 10 green smoothies. It's certainly not because of systemic bias. The message is consistent and persistent. Whatever is wrong, it's your fault. It can't be true that the whole rest of the world is broken or crazy. You're the one who's broken and crazy. You haven't tried hard enough. You haven't done the right things. You don't have what it takes. Eventually, what can we do but believe them? Gaslighting creates deeply uncomfortable feelings of being trapped while making you believe you put yourself in that trap, which just makes you angrier and sadder and less hopeful. Some people who gaslight you are doing it on purpose. They're the bully who grabs your hand and slaps you with it, chanting, "Stop hitting yourself, stop hitting yourself." But not everyone who gaslights is a jerk. Some of them suffer from what we might call patriarchy blindness. We've found two causes of this blindness: human giver syndrome and the headwinds-tailwinds asymmetry. Patriarchy blindness number one: human giver syndrome. At the heart of human giver syndrome lies the deeply buried, unspoken assumption that women should give everything, every moment of their lives, every drop of energy, to the care of others. Self-care is indeed selfish because it uses personal resources to promote a giver's well-being rather than someone else's. Human giver syndrome is the framework on which the second shift hangs, the shrinking but ongoing inequality in the time and effort spent on childcare and housekeeping between men and women. 40 hours per week for women versus an hour and a half for men globally. Even in the most balanced nations, which include the United States, the United Kingdom, and Canada, women still spend 50% more time in this unpaid labor. For example, the difference was 26 hours per week for women versus 16 hours a week for men in the United Kingdom in 2016. Worse, human giver syndrome is the framework on which sexual violence hangs. The basic belief that men have a right to women's bodies, and if a woman looks attractive to a man, or puts herself in a position where a man can take control of her body, well, that's what happens. Men have a right to take what they can get. This isn't just an emotional and cultural dynamic. It has been, and still is, a literal, legally sanctioned reality. For millennia in the United Kingdom, a woman and everything she possessed became the legal property of the man who married her. Only recently did a woman gain the right to keep her own property when she married, 1882, to keep her name, 1924, and not to be raped by her husband, 1991. Human giver syndrome is so deeply ingrained, it takes being confronted with statistics and dates to reveal the imbalances and injustice to us. Without large-scale, objective measurement and historical perspective, it's all too easy to feel comfortable with the familiar inequalities. Human givers don't own or control anything, not even their bodies. So when we hear about a woman being sexually harassed, abused, or assaulted by a man, we lament the ways an accusation of sexual assault or harassment will hinder the man's promising career, and suggest that the woman doing the accusing brought it on herself. Accusers get death threats, and the accused is put on the Supreme Court. In short, it's easy to be blind. So how do we keep our eyes open and help others to see? When we teach college students about human beings and human givers, we ask, what's the solution? What do you think? The first answer students give is nearly always, raise everyone to be human beings. Let's think about that for a second. What would a world look like in which everyone was a human being? Competitive, acquisitive, and entitled. One philosophy major, faced with this image, blurted out, "Solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short," quoting Thomas Hobbes, who saw the state of nature as a war of all against all, because man, whose joy consisteth in comparing himself with other men, is continually in competition for honor and dignity. If we raise everyone to be human beings, the result is eternal war and, or if we follow Hobbes, totalitarian government. Fun. And the fact that so many students automatically assume that the category human beings, that is men, is the default, and human giver, that is women, is the alternative, is itself a symptom of human giver syndrome. It is patriarchy blindness. Now, what if, just what if, we raised everyone to be a version of a human giver? What if we assumed it was every person's moral responsibility to be generous and attentive to the needs of others? What if we assumed no one was simply entitled to have what they wanted from another person, but everyone was supposed to try to help others whenever they could? No one would sit watching television while the other cooked dinner and did the dishes, unless both had mutually agreed that what worked best for both of them was that one should rest while the other gave. No law would allow anyone to take control of another person's body because no one would expect that right. No one would feel the mess of doubt, betrayal, sadness, and rage that comes from being gaslit because no one would gaslight. And when anyone dropped into the pit of despair, the givers who surround them would turn toward them with generous compassion without judgment. The absence of patriarchy makes being a human giver safer. Human giver syndrome is deeply entrenched, and it takes time and practice to eradicate it. Even after spending decades working in sexual violence prevention and response, Emily still notices periodic twinges of human giver syndrome. Fleeting thoughts of, why did she go into his room? Or, why didn't she leave? The goal is not to eliminate these ideas entirely. It is to spot them earlier and earlier, because they're easier to uproot when they're small. To recognize when human giver syndrome may be blinding her to the patriarchy, Emily uses a simple gut check. She asks herself, how would I feel about this if it were a man instead of a woman, or vice versa? Or, am I assuming this woman has a moral obligation to be pretty, happy, calm, generous, or attentive to the needs of others? And, am I assuming this man has a moral right and obligation to be competitive and acquisitive, to take and have anything he can regardless of the impact on others? Human giver syndrome blinds us to the patriarchy, because it constrains our ability to view gender-based inequalities, imbalances, and injustices as unfair. But it's not the only reason a person might be blinded. Patriarchy blindness number two. Headwinds-tailwinds asymmetry. In Emily's long-distance cycling days, she noticed that a flat part of her ride was flatter on the way home than on the way out. Huh, you ask? How could the same road be flatter going south than it was going north? In fact, the flat road had a grade of less than 1% above horizontal. It looked flat, but if it were actually flat, it would have felt the same in both directions, or maybe more difficult on the way home when her legs were fatigued from the 20-plus miles she had just ridden. Yet it felt noticeably easier on the way home. The strangest part is that because it looked flat, her brain and her legs interpreted the sensation of zipping over the southbound road as what flat was supposed to feel like, and the difficulty of the northbound ride as somehow more difficult than flat was supposed to feel. This sort of bias is called the headwinds-tailwinds asymmetry, because people tend to notice their adversarial headwinds and not their helpful tailwinds. It shows up in all kinds of people, in all kinds of situations. Researchers have found that Americans generally believe that the Electoral College and campaign finance systems give unfair advantage to whichever political party they disagree with most, regardless of what the evidence says. People similarly believe their preferred sports team had more disadvantages going into a game than the other team. People even report that their parents were easy on their siblings than on themselves, no matter what their siblings have to say about it. In so many ways, most of us tend to ignore or forget about advantages we've received, but remember the obstacles we've overcome, because the struggle against the obstacles requires more effort and energy than the easy parts. Falling victim to the headwinds-tailwinds asymmetry isn't the same as being a jerk. Jerks complain about being treated unfairly when the reality is they're being treated fairly instead of being given preferential treatment. But most of the time, when people insist, for example, that women don't have it harder than men, they're expressing headwinds-tailwinds asymmetry. When National Public Radio, NPR, covers a new study that shows male doctors are half as likely to introduce a fellow female doctor as Dr. So-and-so, the Facebook comments in response to the story are full of women saying, how screwed up is it that we need a study to prove what every woman knows? And men saying, what about the men's? Those men aren't necessarily jerks. They're just oblivious of their tailwinds. White people inflict their headwind-tailwinds asymmetry on people of color all the time. The road looks flat, so how could it be any less flat for people of color? It must be that the brown person just isn't as strong a cyclist, or they're lazy, or entitled. It can't be a problem with the road. White people are not all jerks, but we are, most of us, victims of the headwinds-tailwinds asymmetry. People from affluent families do it to poor people. Citizens do it to immigrants. Non-disabled people do it to people with disabilities. People in any dominant group find it impossible to believe that the road isn't as flat for others as it is for them. They only know they're working really hard. But there is a simple reality check to help counteract this cognitive bias. Even as Julie was wrestling with her marriage difficulties, she got a new job at a high school in the same school district. It was a big improvement. Better administrators, plus more money, flexibility, and prestige. On top of that, she was in charge of the theater program, which was a dream come true. When I emailed to ask how the new job was going, Julie replied, "I love it. I'm exhausted. It's amazing. My brain is thrilled. My stomach hurts. I'm so lucky. Can you believe this? I'm the first woman ever to run the theater program at this school. What? How?" For the first time, Julie was directing a high school theater production. She had written plays in college and had basic theater training, but she'd never been in charge of the whole thing the way her job now required her to be. So many decisions had to be made. So much work had to be done. She found herself drowning in work, unable to find time to do enough, and having less and less patience in rehearsals. She spoke to the band director, who was in charge of musical direction of the show. He had noticed that she was taking on more responsibility than her predecessor. "Why are you doing all of that?" he asked her. "That is the job of your stage manager, assistant director, stage crew. You don't do any of that." "But they asked for my help." "Of course, they're little baby birds taking their first steps out of the nest. Let them take risks." She felt herself flinch from the idea that her baby birds might fall, naturally identifying with the mother hen. "How do I do that?" she asked. He shrugged. "You just do it." "Okay." Julie realized that her mother henning was the problem. As a mother hen, she was putting not just the needs, but also the wishes, desires, and total comfort of her students ahead of her own work and sanity. She wondered if father cucking was a thing. Julie decided to invent it. She began responding to anyone's assumption that she would take on their responsibilities for them by either telling them that they could handle that task themselves or giving them a name of someone who might be able to help. After a few weeks of this, she compared notes with the band director, and he confirmed that her new approach was more like her predecessor's. It was not a universal success. Students complained. Her administrators asked her why she wasn't taking charge of the play. "I am taking charge," she said. "I'm doing everything my predecessor did, everything the director across town does. I'm asking the students to take initiative." "Well, they say they don't feel that you're supporting them." Why did the students feel differently about her as a director than their previous director? "Human giver syndrome," I suggested. "The expectations for women are different from men, even if no one says it out loud." "So what do I do?" "Keep doing your job, being awesome at it, and eventually the people you work with get used to the fact that you're a person, an individual, a director. Their old expectations will be eroded by your competence." Julie tried, and it helped. Father cocking was smoothing her path through the gendered expectations of her job. But again, it would turn out not to be enough. The Tall Tree Fairness Test. We can imagine the advantages and disadvantages that shape our lives as similar to the natural environment that shapes a tree as it grows. A tree growing on an open, level field grows straight and tall toward the sun. A tree that grows on a hillside will also grow toward the sun, which means it will grow at an angle. The steeper the hill, the sharper the angle of the tree. So if we transplant that tree to the level field, it's going to be a totally different shape from a tree native to that field. Both are adapted to the environment where they grew. We can infer the shape of the environment where a tree grew by looking at the shape of the tree. White men grow on an open, level field. White women grow on far steeper and rougher terrain because the field wasn't made for them. Women of color grow not just on a hill, but on a cliffside over the ocean, battered by wind and waves. None of us chooses the landscape in which we're planted. If you find yourself on an ocean-battered cliff, your only choice is to grow there or fall into the ocean. So if we transplant a survivor of the steep hill and cliff to the level field, natives of the field may look at that survivor and wonder why she has so much trouble trusting people, systems, and even her own bodily sensations. Why is this tree so bent and gnarled? It's because that is what it took to survive in the place where she grew. A tree that's fought wind and gravity and erosion to grow strong and green on a steep cliff is going to look strange and out of place when moved to a level playing field. The gnarled, wind-blown tree from an oceanside cliff might not conform with our ideas of what a tree should look like, but it works well in the context where it grew. And that tall, straight tree wouldn't stand a chance if it was transplanted to the cliffside. One kind of adversity. How many white parents do you know who explicitly teach their children to keep their hands in sight at all times and always say yes, sir, and no, ma'am, if they are stopped by the police? That's just standard operating procedure for a lot of African-American parents. Black parents in America grow their kids differently because the landscape their kids are growing in requires it. The stark difference between how people of color are treated by police and how white people are treated results in white people thinking black people are ridiculous for being afraid of the police. We can't see the ocean, so when black people tell us we do this to avoid falling into the ocean, we don't understand. But just because we can't see it doesn't mean it's not there. How can we tell? By looking at the shape of the tree. Trees that grow at an angle grew on the steep side of a hill. People who are afraid of the police grew up in a world where the police are a threat. Just because the road looks flat doesn't mean it is. Just because you can't see the ocean doesn't mean it's not there. You can infer the landscape by looking at the shapes of the people who grew in those environments. Instead of wondering why they aren't thriving on the level playing field, imagine how the field can be changed to allow everyone to thrive. Compassion fatigue. The patriarchy, not only affects us directly, but it also causes indirect harm to us as we care for others. When we experience stress on behalf of others, we may dismiss it as inconsequential or irrational and ignore it. Givers may spend years attending to the needs of others while dismissing their own stress generated in response to witnessing those needs. This accumulation leads to compassion fatigue, and it's a primary cause of burnout among givers, including those who work in helping professions, many of which are dominated by women, teaching, social work, healthcare, etc. Signs of compassion fatigue include checking out emotionally. Faking empathy when you know you're supposed to feel it because you can't feel the real thing anymore. Minimizing or dismissing suffering that isn't the most extreme. It's not slavery, genocide, child rape, nuclear war, so quit complaining. Feeling helpless, hopeless, or powerless, while also feeling personally responsible for doing more. And staying in a bad situation, whether a workplace or a relationship, out of a sense of grandiosity. If I don't do it, no one will. People who live through traumatic experiences are called survivors. People who love and support people who live through traumatic experiences are co-survivors. They need all the support and care that a survivor needs. If they don't get it, they run the risk of burning out, dropping out, and tuning out. If we want to change the world, we need change agents to know how to receive care. Fortunately, the skills you'll learn in the last section of this audiobook, social connection, rest, and befriending your inner critic, are evidence-based strategies for recovering from and preventing compassion fatigue. It would be great if the world could maybe stop telling us how broken and crazy we are, but we don't have to wait for the world to change in order to stop feeling this way. We can start right now. It's what the rest of this book is about. The first step is knowing the game is rigged, seeing the way the rules are set up, not just to treat some people unequally, but also to blind us to the unfairness of the rules. The next steps are to apply the first three chapters of the book. 1. Complete the cycle to deal with the stress itself. 2, use planful problem solving and positive reappraisal to keep your monitor satisfied. And 3, engage with your something larger, which will heal human giver syndrome. 1, complete the cycle. Feels about the patriarchy. As Gloria Steinem wrote, the truth will set you free, but first it will piss you off. Seeing the rigged game isn't a neutral experience. You'll probably feel some feelings about it as you go through the world spotting the ways the game is rigged and the ways the world is lying to you about the ways the game is rigged. These feelings are uncomfortable. And when they get really intense, it's tempting to ignore them and just stop playing. In other words, burnout. So let's not ignore them. Rage is a big one. A lot of us are carrying around decades of incomplete stress response cycles because human giver syndrome told us we had to be happy and calm and not make other people uncomfortable with our anger. Move, sing, scream, write, chop wood, purge the rage, complete the cycle. Grief is another big one. We mourn for the loss of the life we might have had, the person we might have been if we had been born into a world that believed women are 100% people and that men should be attentive to the needs of others. And it's complicated, too, because this lying, unfair world made you who you are, and a lot of who you are is pretty amazing, right? Not perfect, no one is perfect, but wow, wow! What do you do with the grief? You go through the tunnel. You allow it to move through you. Each time, your best self, the part that makes you go wow, even if you don't yet know who she is, will be with you as you grieve. She is the light at the end. And there's despair. Despair is different from grief. It's the helpless, hopeless feeling we get when our monitors give up on a goal, deciding it is unattainable. Fortunately, science can help us with despair. 2, unlearning helplessness. Do a thing. In those small, short-term experimental conditions, just telling the helpless humans that the game is rigged was enough to make them feel better. But when learned helplessness has been induced over a lifetime of experience, you need to teach your nervous system that it's not helpless. How? You do something. And something is anything that isn't nothing. The patriarchy, is designed like the perfect shuttlebox experiment, frustrating and disappointing us over and over until we give up. But that research also demonstrated how helplessness can be unlearned. Here's how they did it for dogs. After inducing learned helplessness, experimenters physically dragged the dogs over the barrier to the safe side of the shuttlebox. Over and over. By moving its body, and consequently changing its situation, the experimenters led the dog to learn that its physical efforts could result in change. Humans can unlearn helplessness the same way. In Chapter 1, we learned that you don't have to deal with the stressor directly to deal with the stress itself. Helplessness works the same way. When you feel trapped, free yourself from anything, and it will teach your body that you are not helpless. For instance, feeling helpless and hopeless after watching the news about the state of international politics? Don't distract yourself or numb out. Do a thing. Do yard work or gardening to care for your small patch of the world. Take food to somebody who needs a little boost. Take your dog to the park. Show up at a Black Lives Matter march. You might even call your government representative. That's great. That's participation. You're not helpless. Your goal is not to stabilize the government. That's not your job. Unless you happen to be a person whose job that is, in which case you still need to deal with the stress as well as the stressor. Your goal is to stabilize you so that you can maintain a sense of efficacy, so that you can do the important stuff your family and your community need from you. As the saying goes, nobody can do everything, but everybody can do something. And something is anything that isn't nothing. It's likely that you've received the message that when you're feeling overwhelmed with helplessness, it's because you just can't be rational. You're just overreacting. and the problem is your mindset or your weakness or just generally your fault. You should be able to do just as well as any man, and if you can't, the problem is you. It's not true, and the people who say it are gaslighting you. The truth is you learned helplessness from experiences of being helpless. We unlearn helplessness by doing a thing that uses our body. Go for a walk, scream into a pillow, or as Carrie Fisher put it, take your broken heart and make it into art. Reverse the effects of helplessness by creating a context where you can do a thing. In the animated movie Finding Nemo, we get to know Dory, a blue tang, a friendly fish who suffers from short-term memory loss. Famously voiced by Ellen DeGeneres, Dory advises her friends to just keep swimming when things are difficult. She even sings a song about it. In Finding Dory, we learn, spoiler, that it was her parents who taught her that even with her short-term memory loss, there was always a way to get through a difficulty. If you just keep swimming, you'll find your way. And when your brain wants to give up because there's no land in sight, you keep swimming, not because you're certain swimming will take you where you want to go, but to prove to yourself that you can still swim. 3. Smash. You're completing the cycle. You're doing things, using your body to remind yourself that you are not helpless. Step 3. Smash the patriarchy. Smash it to pieces. You smash it by making meaning, engaging with your something larger in ways that heal human giver syndrome. To assist you in this, we've provided a Smashin' Some Patriarchy worksheet available as a PDF with your audiobook. A caveat. Don't smash with the goal of ending the patriarchy. You are not going to see the end of gender inequality, or racial inequality, or any other inequality. You are going to see progress, just as you can see that progress has happened over the last 100 years. Instead, your goal, which, remember, should be soon, certain, positive, concrete, specific, and personal, can be something like, buy all my friends' birthday presents from woman-owned stores. Or, in every meeting, invite women to speak first. Or, give my boys a lesson each day in being a human giver. Or just smash daily. Put a reminder in your calendar. Did you smash today? Sophie was practicing explaining the unwinnable game to Emily. Nobody would need this workshop if they could just spend an hour being me. People ask if my hair is real. My doctor tells me I'm too fat for him to take my pulse. Teenagers throw garbage at me from their car while I'm walking down the sidewalk. And yet you don't blow up the building, Emily said. You're a frickin' superhero. Yes, Sophie said emphatically. Racism, sexism, sizism, microaggressions, macroaggressions. This system is brutal and there's no beating it. It's the Kobayashi Maru. None of us is getting out of this alive, but I win every time because I prove my character. Look how strong it made me. Look how smart it made me. She gestured down at herself. Look how hot it made me. Emily nodded. You are the new hotness. What Emily meant by that is the subject of the next chapter. Looking at the scale and scope of the rigging can be painful, scary, and enraging and overwhelming. No wonder people hate the word patriarchy. It's a word that exposes and names a source of pain so old and deep, we've learned to ignore it or treat it as if it's how life should be. In general, self-help type books try to help people feel good, empowered, and in control of their lives, so they leave this chapter out. Acknowledging the large-scale social forces that surround you does not necessarily feel good, empowering, or like you're in control. But it's also like looking at the climate. It's where you live. You can't escape it. And you can change it only in tiny, tiny increments. If you don't plan for it, you won't know when to plant and when to harvest. If you don't acknowledge it, you won't notice that it's changing, that your world is being cooked alive, and you won't be able to fix it. And we're not done. There's another enemy, one you confront each and every day, It tells you it's your friend, when really it's trying to kill you slowly. That's what the next chapter is about. TLDR. The game is rigged. Women and girls, especially women and girls of color, are systematically excluded from government and other systems of power. It's called patriarchy, ugh. The patriarchy, ugh, says it doesn't exist. It says that if we struggle, it's our own fault for not being good enough, which is gaslighting. Human giver syndrome, the contagious belief that you have a moral obligation to give every drop of your humanity in support of others, no matter the cost to you, thrives in the patriarchy the way mold thrives in damp basements. The solution? Smash. See worksheet.